Salam, hello, peace to you all. This is Adnan Hussein with a quick message ahead of a bonus full audio of a recent live stream on my YouTube channel. So this is an extra for you on the podcast feed. We know these are momentous and historically significant times, the genocide in Gaza, war on Iran, stifling blockade upon Cuba, the kidnapping of an elected head of state in Venezuela, ICE raids and fascism and anti-immigrant far-right politics metastasizing in the entire West. The world is in turmoil, and bringing historical political analysis by scholarly experts and anti-imperialist intellectuals for our understanding and political education is vital right now if we are to help reshape the world for a better human future. That's my goal with this educational project. And if you can support it, I will be immensely grateful. You'll get early release of episodes, full audio of every YouTube live stream, some bonus readings and commentaries just for supporters, but most of all, the knowledge that you are helping keep all the episodes and live streams on YouTube, whether office hours, struggle sessions, or my solo video commentaries, free and available on YouTube for everyone else who benefits but can't afford right now to contribute financially during these difficult economic times. You can become a patron or a supporter in a variety of ways, but I do just want to mention that I do this for the love of it, to use my knowledge and that of my guests for political education and understanding and advancing our cause and struggle for justice. But I do have a production team and platform fees. And if you can help me a little bit there, my production team deserves, fair compensation for the hard work they do. So if you can help me, then you can become a patron on patreon.com/Adnan Hussein or a supporting subscriber on Substack at AdnanAHussein.substack.com, or make a one-time contribution via buymeacoffee.com/Adnan Hussein. Peace and solidarity with you all.
Allah Rahman Rahim.
Salam, hello, peace to you all, and welcome to another special live stream focusing on the real issues at hand, concurrent developments in the war on Iran, or as we liked to frame it, especially today on day two, we can definitely say that Iran hits back against the Epstein Empire. We're going to talk about all of that and more with a very wonderful group of panelists. So before I introduce them briefly and get straight into the discussion, I do want to remind everybody to like the stream so that people will find out about it. If you want, you could even share it on your social media and tell people. And perhaps you can also subscribe to the channel. We've been having a lot of live streams, especially in this moment. I don't always get a chance to give a huge amount of advance warning. But if you're a subscriber, there's a better chance you'll find out about it. And of course, one of the biggest fears you have as a true tanky lefty is fear of missing out on the really good stuff. So don't miss out. You don't have to. You can always watch this back, but it's great to be here and in the discussion. So also post your questions, comments, topics. I'll be trying to peruse that, in the course of our conversation. And if I think there's something that might make a good topic for the panelists I'll draw it out. So post them in the chat. Let's do it. So I'm really excited for this because these are some great comrades, and you know, we want to like see what we can, what sense we can make of what's been going on. Because as one of our panelists already remarked to me, there's just like so much coming in to deal with and process. And so that's what we're going to try and do a little bit of together. So this is a collaboration with Resistance is Fertile podcast. It's streaming there on X and also on Substack. And, you know, one of the co-hosts of Resistance is Fertile is the inimitable Benji Schoendorf, radical anti-imperialist psychologist and co-host of Resistance is Fertile. Benji, welcome, brother. It's great to see you.
Thank you, Brother Adnan. I couldn't think of a better way to spend this Sunday night of what looks very much like the final battle against the genocidal empire than in your beautiful company and that of Brother David, who is the person I credit with bringing Iran to life in my heart and in my soul when we had this conversation on the channel, and also the wonderful Indy from the Indica blog, who I think you were the first blogger who I was flabbergasted by how openly you posted about the resistant texts at a time when quite a few of us were still a little bit, you know, afraid. So yeah, what a great day. I feel so grateful to be with you guys in this absolutely world historical moment.
Indeed. Well, a lot there. And of course, you've basically told us that we are lucky to have indie blogger at indie.ca co-host with you, Benji, of Resistance is Fertile, whom I met for the first time on your impromptu emergency live stream very early on a Saturday morning.
Feels like a lifetime away, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It does. Indy, it's great to see you again and to have met you recently. Welcome, comrade.
Yeah, thank you very much. My wife always tells me I should get out more and meet people, so I really appreciate these opportunities.
Right. How you get to stay in and meet people. I mean, what could be better?
Yeah, it's the best of both worlds.
That's right. And of course, my friend of, you know, I shouldn't say how many decades because that just will make us all feel really old. But my friend, comrade, colleague, who I was lucky enough to go through his, you know, kind of encouragement and invitation to accompany him to Iran for the first time in December, Professor David Yagubian from Cal State San Bernardino, friend of the show, and has appeared many episodes talking about Iran. Dave, it's great to see you, man.
Great to see all three of you. Like as Benji said, there's nowhere else I'd rather be right now. We'll see where it goes, but I emotionally today, I've been from tears to like, you know, hearty belly laughs. People have amazing sense of humor, and things are just extremely dire as well. I mean, we'll talk about the resistance side, which I'm very heartened and encouraged, but it's been an insane roller coaster of the last essentially almost 48 hours. And so this is actually sort of a time to collect my and our thoughts, I think, because the monitoring, if you will, side of things is just nonstop. So great to have this time and great to see you all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe that's the place to start, is like, what are our major impressions after the first 2 days? And it's been filled with news and developments, including, you know, the initial news and strikes. You know, we've come to learn after the end of the first day, very late, with real confirmation that there were some, you know, losses in people who are made martyrs, among them, you know, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. You know, this itself also is worth remarking that, you know, I think this is the end he would have wanted for himself. Like, he would not have complained about, you know, resisting to the end, working, you know, not hiding out, you know, trying to extend his, you know, life, but rather being in service to the very end for his nation, his people, and being martyred during Ramadan, leading his people, making a massive contribution, fulfilling his life mission, and really perhaps in death serving to really be the emblem, you know, for the resistance. So, you know, Muslims believe that the martyrs are not dead, but they live with us and live on. And in some sense, his legacy is so important and powerful, and the consequences of his sacrifice, you know, might actually mean that he is going to be with us, you know, because as Benji said, this feels like world historical time. So, you know, maybe that's a place to start, is just how people are interpreting and understanding it. Then we can talk a little bit about latest developments in Iran's hitting back against the Epstein Empire, because imperialists go for the shock and awe, and they go for these assassinations, illegal assassinations. They want to disorient us. They have this orientalist idea that without your oriental despotic leader, the society will be completely at a loss and confused and paralyzed and unable, you know, to act in concert in an organized and considered fashion. And we have seen, of course, exactly the opposite when it comes to Iran hitting back. And so we'll want to talk about that. But why don't we go around and just open it up? So, Indy, how are you feeling about the state of affairs, and particularly, you know, this news that we've had to absorb in the first day?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's important to remind people that it wasn't just Khamenei that was killed. There were people high within the military establishment, and also his daughter and his granddaughter, like a beautiful baby girl. And I'm always reminded of that. Even when Abu Obeida was martyred, they killed his young son also. And that's the scale of child-killing empire we're facing. They're really trying to kill the future. And I think the martyr, Ali Khamenei, he certainly knew what he was doing. He went to work that day knowing exactly what that work entailed. And I mean, as the notorious BIG said, I think he was ready to die. And growing up as a young man, I always heard about rappers and musicians, which is my culture growing up in America, but I heard about them after they die. And I think everyone will hear about Khamenei now. They'll hear a lot of lies about him. They're still spreading this idea that he's some evil tyrant. I invite anyone to read Khamenei. His website is largely in English. He has a lot of excellent philosophical work and some really sweet and charming tweets. He was a great man. We were very lucky to live at the same time as him. And as the Quran says, don't think of the people who are martyred in God's cause as dead. They are alive. You're just not aware of it. And I feel that very much. I do feel like when Nasrallah was martyred, I felt very sad. I was pretty depressed and mean for weeks. I feel differently with Khamenei. I don't know why, but I feel differently. I feel more hopeful somehow.
Yeah, more hopeful. I mean, I agree with you. That really hit me, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah's. Like, that was hard for me to get over. I thought, what's going to happen? You know, I had invested so much in this charismatic leadership of his, and the fact that he was so frightening to, you know, the Zionists, you know, it was just like, here was somebody who had battled with them and whom they feared, you know? So that loss, but, you know, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is not been in the forefront, right, of our, except maybe more recently, he's actually been out giving a lot of speeches that, you know, people have been interested in because of the impending war. They've been paying attention, but he's made a lot of recent public statements, very defiantly saying, you know, we're not, why should we be afraid of these aircraft carriers? You know, a greater weapon is something that might sink it. So, like, you know, and so that I'm still waiting and hoping to see what he has, you know, in a way sort of promised. I mean, I hope to see it, but I think you're right. Like, because it somehow feels less devastating to the cause and more, in fact, actually inspiring to the resistance, right, is the effect that it will have. Sayyid Hassan, it seemed like it did demoralize in some ways Hezbollah's movement at that moment that they were in. But this seems, when we see that, you know, there are people, I saw videos of people in Nigeria, you know, showing their solidarity and grief, but not in a sad way, but defiant way. And we're seeing that, of course, in Lebanon with hundreds of thousands of people coming into the streets. So that does feel a little different. So I'm with you, on that. Anybody else? How are you?
Yeah. If I may go now, because I want David to have the last word on this on this part of our conversation. There is somebody who's being disrespectful in the chat. Could you do you know how to get rid of them, or just maybe tell you don't speak that way of someone who's been martyred, please? It's not the kind of space that I feel we want to have together here. Indeed, you put words to something I'd been feeling and kind of felt a little bit guilty about. I was also very shaken by the death of Nasrallah and the murder of Nasrallah. And if you recall, you know, I think they dropped 80 tons of explosive on Nasrallah, which is like the explosive power of a small nuclear device, just to get this one person in the southern suburbs of Beirut. And in a way, you know, Khamenei had said he would not hide. He said, my body is frail. I'm an old man. I am not that useful to the cause anymore, being alive. And when I heard about his death, I didn't feel the same sense. And you know, folks will know I'm autistic, and sometimes I feel, well, maybe I don't feel grief in the right place, or maybe sometimes I'm too in the abstract ideas and I can't connect to the real feeling. But my immediate feeling was it really chose it, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was this U.S. journalist who published this scoop, you know. He said, scoop, the CIA located Khamenei and passed his coordinates onto the Mossad. I mean, you could have found him on Google Maps, you know, and I responded, yeah, there's another scoop, you know. The CIA located the Kremlin in Moscow and passed on the coordinates to the Ukrainians. And this man had decided that by being martyred at this particular time, or taking the risk to be martyred, which he must have known. I mean, we know this is the decapitation empire, right? They decapitate you and then they try to eat you in the jerky form. I think that's the case. And there was in the book of Gabriel Rockhill, they even said that when they went after Che Guevara, which the whole of the empire was after, it was the CIA who wanted Che Guevara. They actually wanted his head brought back to DC, right? And in the end, the guy didn't want to do it, so they just got a finger or two. But this is literally a flesh-eating empire of demons. And it's very good that they're showing it to us, because it's giving us the Marxists, the socialists, the people who, like me, don't have religious faith, and I don't judge it. I just can't have it. You know, I can't make myself believe stuff I don't believe, but I respect so fully the people who have this belief that it gives us a way to unite across those divides, which I believe are artificial, because everybody has the right to live their life, their existence, their spirituality in whatever way feels right to them. And we are seeing them for the demons they are. And going at this particular moment is the perfect, and also the, I think the general, the chief of the general staff of the army went, perfect way to show that this isn't a tyranny. This isn't a one-man show. This isn't a fragile regime. This is a popular democracy. I'm not saying I would organize the same way. I have no idea. I'm not in charge of organizing a democracy. But clearly, it's supported by the vast majority of the people, whatever else it's been doing. And I've been learning so much about Khamenei. It's been since June, actually. But you see all his tweets, and he was such a nice man. He tweets about how he loves Les Miserables, the Victor Hugo. I saw today, you know, I was thinking, I'm reminded of the demon Milikowski speaking in front of Congress and saying, those trans people who and LGBTQ people who support Palestine, they're like chicken supporting KFC or something. And today, you know, I saw several tweets that said in 1981, 2 years after the Islamic Revolution, there was a fatwa, a religious edict that said it was legal to transition surgically from one gender to the next. That was Khomeini, right? The predecessor to Khamenei. And Khamenei himself reaffirmed it. And it turns out many people from the region actually will go to Iran to transition. So, you know, dear LGBTQ brothers and sisters, you've actually chosen the right side when you've supported the free people of the world. All these stories about, you know, pushing people off buildings are absolutely false. They have nothing to do with people's sexuality. And another thing I discovered about, I saw this video, it's the first time I saw it today, of Ali Khamenei. So he was wounded in the war against Iraq, which was an imperialist conspiracy. The dear Germans actually gave, as Germans like to do, you know, poison gas to gas the Iranian population. And all the time, that medieval regime, as they want us to believe, chose to never respond in kind at the cost of hundreds of thousands, possibly million more dead than they would have had, right? And this man, when it was his turn to be chosen, when he was chosen as the spiritual leader of the country, they actually filmed it was a secret meeting, but they filmed it, right? And he refused. He stood up and he said, no, I don't really know that much. I don't have the religious authority. I'm not prepared. I'm not worthy. I'm not a leader. I won't be able to lead. And it was Rafsanjani who was going to be the president later, or maybe, I don't know if he was at the time, I'm sorry if my history is not perfect, who said, that's enough talk, let's vote. And you see, and he says, everybody who's for, stand up. Everybody stands up, except for Khamenei. And you see the poor man crying, you know, like, this is not some crazed, power-hungry tyrant. Not in a million years. Then you see his house, and his house is, this guy was literally the Pepe Mujica of Iran, right? His meeting room where he met the people he worked with, he had the cheapest table probably you could find in the Tehran bazaar, plastic chairs piled up on top of one another, a carpet that has nothing to it. This was a simple man dedicated to study, dedicated to philosophy, dedicated to his spirituality, dedicated to leading his people against his own will and better judgment. When you see that example of a man, you know that what he does is deliberate. And I choose to believe that he chose to be a martyr at this particular time because now he's leading the people through the people, whereas, you know, nobody can say, oh, they're all under the yoke of this guy. No, he's not there anymore. And the people is rising and they are reaping the genocidal empire, an orifice which I hope is the gates of hell opening right under their feet.
We'll get to those gates of hell. Yes. I just wanted to put on the screen. This is.
Can you move your logo, because we can't see your beautiful face anymore?
Well, I'll be back in a moment. Yeah, I could move it to the other side, couldn't I? That would be
with Captain Thomas Sankara. Yeah, here we go.
There we go. But I put it, him with Thomas Sankara. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, a lot of people think that, this kind of support of the Palestinians is just something that's related to, this Middle East Islam. Okay, they had a vision, Islamic Republic of Iran was committed to anti-imperialism around the globe. And here's, visual testimony that here's the supreme leader before he became the supreme leader, sitting with Thomas Sankara, right? So two martyrs, right, of Western Crusader Empire. Dave.
I just agree so wholeheartedly with everything that's been said so far. And some of it I couldn't have said myself because I would cry, because I tend to be a crier. So good job with that, Indy, hanging through that. But, just in the context of what you just said, Adnan, the long struggle against imperialism, I feel like the death of and the assassination, let's just, be straight with that, but the assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei is for me very different than the assassination of Nasrallah, in the sense that I think everyone has a mission and everyone has their time, if you will. And the completion and the longevity of Ayatollah Khamenei's work and his mission. I won't say that I exactly saw this coming, but it was very clear over the last few weeks as he was giving speeches to community groups and to students and was just out there. I kind of felt that he was ready for this. And so if people can understand this, you need to really understand the culture of Shia Islam. But I'm more stunned by his achievement than I am saddened by his loss. I hate to draw from this pop cultural analogy, but it's sort of like Obi-Wan Kenobi and the robe falling on the ground. Like, his power just grows exponentially. Of course, this is also because of his age, so we can't discount that. It's just Nasrallah had many more years to participate in the resistance. Ayatollah Khamenei, basically, and I heard Adnan mm-hmm. earlier when you were with Navid and Nina, you mentioned this, the video that's been going around. I've sent it to people, but Ayatollah Khamenei basically taking his own advice that he gave to the young boy who wanted to become a Shahid, a martyr. He said, study hard, which Ayatollah Khamenei did, grow up, get tall, serve Islam, which Ayatollah Khamenei did deeply. And then when you're 80 to 90, you can become a martyr. And that is exactly what he did. So I'm sort of in awe of his achievement, especially in light of, and this might be a segue to what we are going to be talking about, but in light of how he has enabled and empowered and released the Iranian nation to do whatever is necessary at this time to defeat the Zio-Pedo American Empire and to optimally not only secure security for Iranians, but the entire region and potentially for all of Eurasia. And if you want, if you will, the pivot area. And so it's truly an epic battle to draw from some of the terminology that has been employed. And I'm just, again, I don't know that many of my friends and family don't understand this, but I'm incredibly heartened by the leadership and the example that Ayatollah Khamenei has set, and the lifelong effort and action in resistance that his biography illustrates so brilliantly. So it's even specifically in this context, I've been talking to others and my wife about Nasrallah and how I still haven't really wrapped my head around that or dealt with that, but it's just very different for Ayatollah Khamenei. So clearly this makes me emotional to talk about, my heart is filled with his memory and the power. It's sort of like a Shia energy pill that he has released globally. Yeah. So,
Can I just say, David, I'm a clinical psychologist, so it's okay to cry. It's okay to feel whatever you're feeling.
Oh, yeah, man. No, my mom, I grew up on Rosie Grier, you know. My mom was big on Rosie Grier. It's all right to cry, you know, free to you and me. So I have to say, I've gotten a lot of mileage out of it over the years with the students.
And as always, it's always the mother's fault, right? We know where it comes from.
Yeah. I mean, if we think about like what some of the consequences and implications going forward, you know, we've mentioned some of them, but, you know, as Ode to John Trudell has posted, and I've seen reports about this and even some video, Al Mayadeen English reports Hezbollah has launched missiles towards occupied Palestine. And we know that these were like, if Hezbollah has entered into the active resistance, active participation in this battle, it is partly in response to, commitments and promises they've made, you know, to avenge, the Marja, you know, a spiritual leader, a guide, kind of the Marja for resistance, really, you would say. You know, there are other Marjas, but like he's the Marja, that is the person who gives authoritative religious guidance to those, in Shi'i Islam, to those in the resistance. He's really, you know, the figure. And we might say also, Commander Fidel Castro warned, in 2010 that if the U.S. and Israel were to attack the Islamic Republic of Iran, it would have consequences, he predicted, of nuclearizing the conflict. And this is one thing that it may be a miscalculation on the part of Epstein Empire, is thinking, oh, we'll get rid of their like leader, and that will kind of throw them into confusion and allow us through shock and awe to have the psychological consequence, have to put our boots on the ground. They'll collapse, you know, like we'll be able to win by doing this. That in fact, actually, it could open the way, because he is the figure whose authoritative religious juridical opinion has been that weapons of mass destruction, specifically nuclear weapons, are an abomination and not allowable in Islamic law. But, you know, as I like to tell people, Islamic law is flexible. And do you think in this time that his successor will not take potentially a very different view of that position? So, you know, there are potentially lots of implications and consequences of this. But that helps us transition into like how Iran has been striking back, you know, even before we think about what they might do. And also the fact that if Hezbollah is joining now, you know, it wasn't something that Iran called for or demanded earlier on, right? They said, we're okay on our own at this stage of the battle. But this shows that they are not proxies of Iran. This is a decision that would be taken by, you know, Hezbollah and Lebanon saying, this matters to us. They've crossed a red line. This horrible empire has to be confronted right now. That's their decision, you know, to do so. So anyway, I wanted to open up like what the response has been to the initial attacks. What do you, you know, notice and think about? What are the key points? You know,
so should I do a quick run of play just to say in the past 24 hours, the places, the countries they've hit, I'm putting countries in quotes for a reason. Yeah. So occupied Palestine, Israel, United States, all there. So and the IRGC has said, you know, we're not attacking you, UAE, but you guys, that's American soil that you put on your land as an American, like they've soiled your land. So the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Jordan, Iraq, and within Iraq, there's resistance now, I think, from the Blood Brigades, Bahrain, Oman, I don't know, because Oman is a bit of a friendly, Syria, as in occupied Syria now, Cyprus, there's a UK base there and America bases out of there. France's Camp de la Paix, the ironically named Camp de la Paix in UAE, has been hit, and NATO, an Italian NATO camp in, I forget, in Ali al-Salem base. So I think this ties back to something Nasrallah said, which I'll quote from an old speech of his. He said, we are now intent on removing colonialism from this region, doing away with colonial means of information and culture and making people understand Islam as it should be understood. He said, we do not believe in multiple Islamic republics. We do believe, however, in a single Islamic world governed by a central government, because we consider all borders throughout the Muslim world as fake and colonialist, and therefore doomed to disappear. Therefore, in order for this project to be realized, priority should be given to removing Israel from the scene, because it was established for the express purpose of dividing and partitioning the Muslim world. This is from a longer speech where he's basically reassuring people that Islam is not like, I mean, ISIS didn't exist at the time, but Islam isn't oppressive like that. If this, like, this, I mean, the invocation of Muslim here doesn't bother me at all. But as you can see, like, they've had a plan for decolonizing this region for a long time. And yeah. Nasrallah said, we don't expect that we'll walk into Jerusalem soon, but we do expect that we'll walk into Jerusalem, you know, at some point. And they have been planning for this. And then when America tries to decapitate, Iran has evolved to not be decapitated. They proceed in ranks. And when one rank falls, another rank falls in. By persecuting and by oppressing Iran for so many generations, they have ensured that this revolution, this decolonial revolution is a regenerating process. And it will continue to regenerate. And they have planned for this day. Whereas I think the United States has not planned, and not planning is planning to fail, as they say.
Yeah. So I'm not going to speak too much about the military stuff, I guess.
That's something Dave loves, so we'll
let great. So I'll let him do that. I also love it, but I know I'm not an expert. I'll only say that I've known since 2017, and I came across Andrei Marchanov's first book, Losing Military Supremacy. I've actually known that the military goose of the empire was cooked. And since then, things have just gone even more in the direction of the empire losing military supremacy. To be very short about it, is if you have a military industrial complex that is meant to maximize shareholder value, it can't maximize battlefield effectiveness. So you end up with boutique weapons that are just made to be super expensive, and they need those rare earths that Comrade Xi has decided to not sell anymore through bureaucratic chicanery. And they have demilitarized themselves in Ukraine, and by holocausting Gaza with more bombs than, was it 80 Hiroshimas or something? And they simply don't have stuff left. And plus, what they have doesn't work except for maximizing shareholder value. So they are done for. But I want to look at the psychological side of things. And on the psychological side of things, it is my conviction, it's the reason also why I speak, that there is a psychological war going on. It's going on 24/7, and our minds are the targets. You know, as the great late Michael Parenti said, they don't care anything about you. They don't care if you live or if you die. They care nothing for you. The only thing they care about you is what you think. This they care desperately about. And all they do, especially because they are lost in Western idealism, is about what we think, is about narratives. So we need to think of ourselves when we speak publicly at any kind of level to anyone in the world, that we are actually, because we've been drafted by empire and maybe by life, maybe by whatever, soldiers who maybe haven't chosen to be there on a battlefield, psychological battlefield front. So we have a duty to be responsible with what we say. Amilcar Cabral said, you know, tell no lies and claim no easy victories, right? So make sure you don't tell lies, but at the same time, know the sources you use. In a conflict like this, on which you know which side you are, and hopefully you're watching this, you're on the side of humanity and not on the side of the death-worshipping, cannibalistic, pedo-criminal demons, then you only trust sources who are on the side of life. So you don't publish anything that you've read through, I don't know what, you know, Axios, New York Times, except to make fun of them, right? But you wait until the people who are on the side of life and really fighting for it on the material battlefield put out the message. That is absolutely important. And the other thing is what we are seeing today is things are absolutely not going the way they imagine, because the problem they have is they drink their own Kool-Aid. And the most toxic part of their Kool-Aid, which has been brewing and fermenting for the past 500 years, is the racist supremacist part of it, which has actually convinced them to their bone that, I'm almost ashamed to say it as a white person, brown people are not human enough to be just as smart as them if they have the same information in front of them. Not only can they be just as smart as them, they can be smarter because they are not blinded by arrogance and hubris, so they work their little backsides off. Iran is one of the countries with the highest rates of engineers in high tech, including, I think, female engineers at a level we don't even imagine. Mm-hmm. And so they have it. They have the technology. And then when they tell you we have the weapons, believe them. And now they have Chinese satellite that cannot be jammed by the empire with the precision. Have you seen those and their commercial satellite images from the Chinese? Mm-hmm. So on the material front, and as a Marxist, I know it's the final battle, by the way, between dialectical materialism, I'm not saying godless materialism, right, and idealism, people who think just making stuff up in their minds, they can make it appear in the world, which is Trump, you know, to a T. And the fight is going really well. So our duty is to pump ourselves up, not with lies, not by claiming easy victory. That was not an easy victory, right? That was many, many decades in the making. They spoke of strategic patience, not for nothing. You know, they didn't respond so many times. They let their We, the free people of the world, not because, you know, I don't want to claim any glory, but we need to see we're on the same side. We let our leaders be killed without responding. We let them walk all over us. We let them genocide a large part of us in the name of strategic patience, right? And they basically open themselves the door of their own hell. So long as I don't have information that contradicts this, and maybe David can give us the real military goodies, this is what's going on now. And brothers and sisters, this is pretty good news. I'm 62 years old. I've been waiting for a day like this since I think I learned about the Nazi Holocaust of the Jews at the tender age of 8 years old, and it broke my eternal soul. Ooh, did you see, Indy? I stopped it just before I said.
Yeah, we've been trying to not to swear because all the Western swear words are like basically Epstein-y, like sexual related. Yeah. Let's move on.
Extraordinary discipline there, self-control. but for you, Benji, just a quick thing before we get to those goodies. Since you were talking about as a therapist, you know, somebody who understands therapy and psychological war, I saw a very funny tweet, and I think these are the kinds of things perhaps Dave was saying amid the horror of the devastating violence upon civilians. And we see the schoolgirls, 100 of them in one strike. And in fact, almost all of the casualties that
I choose to believe this is a deliberate sacrifice to Epstein. Yeah. This is what I choose to believe. It's opening salvo. They go and kill over 100 primary school girls.
Yeah,
I saw a joke, which is true, which is that Khamenei is the spiritual leader of Iran and Jeffrey Epstein is the spiritual leader of the empire.
It's no joke. It's no joke, my
right.
friend.
The supreme leader, Jeffrey Epstein. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, that's amazing. I mean, so that is more than just an irony, as you're pointing out. I mean, this is absolutely fitting. And in absorbing that, that's like a horror. But then there are also some funny things that people do post, which is that you thought, you know, you needed, for years, you thought you needed therapy. then you realized all you needed to see was Tel Aviv burn. You know, as opposed to like all these people who are like celebrating and are happy and are uplifted, not because they take pleasure in human suffering, but because they want to see the Epstein Empire destroyed. And it's come to this, that this is all that we have left. Like all of the other efforts have not worked. It is now up to, unfortunately, Iran making the sacrifice to take on the Epstein Empire and give it a blow that it will not recover from.
May I just say, as a clinical therapist, you know, that is evidence-based treatment, right? Seeing those images of those satanic demons getting their comeuppance at last is soul cleansing. You know, part of what keeps people in mental suffering is having to live in a pedo criminal, flesh-eating, cannibalistic capitalist system. This is what makes most people live in a state of constant mental suffering. You know, why is it an epidemic? Why do we have all these so-called mental diseases we didn't have before? Because capitalism is eating away at the very soul of what it is to be human.
Yes. So, Dave, how do you think they're doing in striking back against the Epstein Empire?
I will get to that, but I just want to say I really appreciate how Benji just framed this, the explanation of the racist supremacist component to the ongoing machinations of American empire and its sort of Zionist component. And the reason I'm going to begin with that is I think that could help to explain why Benji was ahead of me back in August when I was arguing that based on soft and hard power dynamics, which were identifiable and traceable, that there would not be another attack on Iran. And what I was admonished, hey, don't underestimate their stupidity, their racism. And so let me just say then in that context, one of the reasons why my conversation with Benji a couple of weeks ago, our conversations recently, Adnan, I was leaning towards the United States isn't going to do it because we all know the realities of American weaponry, as you all have described, you know, Iran's defensive capabilities having been demonstrated, all of these things, regional dynamics, everything, the Strait of Hormuz, the economy, all of these things, right? And nevertheless, they went ahead. I still, all the way up until the very end, I texted a colleague, I won't out him, but just a few nights ago saying, Iran just dodged the biggest bullet that the United States will ever have. And I was, of course, abjectly wrong. And so now, with that said, look at what the result has been, and we can talk about that. But Israel and the pedo American empire are being resolutely spanked by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that doesn't mean that Iranians aren't dying and that there isn't destruction going on in Iran. But this is how I thought it was going to go and why, therefore, I argued that they're not going to be that stupid. Furthermore, let me just add, I'm shocked in terms of the dynamics. If you remember the three floating points of dynamic interpretation, that is U.S. soft and hard power, Iranian soft and hard power, Zionist soft and hard power. Think about the context in which the final blowout war between Iran and the United States has finally happened. The Epstein files, the Huckabee interview, you know, the ongoing genocide in Palestine. This is why I just kept, in terms of my analysis of those dynamics, did not think that it would be possible. And then furthermore, Iran having had a full 6+ months to recover after the 12-day war, which every day of that 6 months, you know, I was aware that another day had gone by and that you know, some of even the recently martyred leadership of Iranian military, they work every day of those, interim months. And so this is, I'll just say then, to kind of end that segment of my, you know, my incorrect analysis, it's sort of like the basis of my analysis has been revealed. This is why I was arguing that the U.S. isn't going to be stupid enough to do it. And therefore, back to Benji's excellent insights, you know, if one can't understand it, which I can't intellectually understand, we must go back then to their their psyche, their psychosis, and their, you know, racist supremacist ideology to understand how they could think that this would be successful, how they could think that this would pull it off. And I'll bring it full circle to Khamenei, how you could think that killing Ayatollah Khamenei at age 86 in this context, coming from the barrel of the pedo-Zionist Epstein gun, would not just fully enrage and fuel the resistance globally. So I'm just stunned at their stupidity, and I'd say I'm more pleased to see that the expectations that I and many other observers had of Iranian military strength and Iranian national cohesion and national identity have been borne out, and we can see it happening right now on the streets of Tehran and other cities. As not only are people not going into sweaty bunkers, as I have a friend actually in Israel who is in one right now, but they're taking to the streets to demonstrate their support for the revolution, their mourning over the loss of Ayatollah Khamenei, and their anger over the ongoing violence and murder of the pedo-Zionist empire. So it's a good day for the resistance, and it's increasingly, as we can tell, very, very difficult times for the Zio imperialist empire and its cheerleaders.
May I make just a small point, Brother David? I think to fully get how high they are on the supremacist Kool-Aid, I'm afraid you need to have been born a white person amongst white people and decided to become a serious race and class traitor, because the problem with the dehumanizers is they dehumanize themselves as they dehumanize the others, but the folks they dehumanize never doubted for a minute that they are human, and they don't even doubt that the dehumanizers are human. So it's very hard for the dehumanized, not because they all feel dehumanized and colonized in the mind, but because they are so fully human, to realize that supremacy turns you into an actual demon, right? And this is kind of, it's been a weakness historically, because, you know, you sign treaties with people thinking they're equal humans that you can sign treaties with, but they're just doing it so that they can, you can turn away from the treaty ceremony and they can knife you in the back.
Mm-hmm. And David, I'd like to add, so you said your military analysis was off, but that is actually the conventional U.S. military analysis, that war with Iran would be ruinous. And yeah, if you don't mind, I'll read, this is a report called U.S. Bases in the Middle East, Overcoming the Tyranny of Geography, from 2024 by some guy, Spuds McKinsey. So it says, our current basing structure, inherited from years of haphazard decision-making and driven by divergent operational political principles, has yielded installations that are not, and this is understating it, not optimally situated for the most likely threats of today and the future in the region. And what this guy talks about is actually what Iran is hitting right now. He says the United States considers a naval base at Manama, Bahrain, to be the main operating base for CENTCOM. It is the headquarters of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, the naval component. There are air bases in Qatar, UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Jordan. These bases are typically dual-use facilities and host nation aircraft operating out of there. And he says basically, well, we can move our troops out, these guys can't move out of their country, which becomes obviously a problem for those people. And this is the money quote. He says, United States will not be able to maintain these bases in a full-throated conflict because they will be rendered unusable by sustained Iranian attack. It is a simple tyranny of geography. Our current bases are shared with host countries. These nations do not have the option of relocating in the event of war with Iran. So this is the internal U.S. military reports. And you could see from the leaks, not just from the toilets, but from the generals leading up to this war, that there was significant trepidation about launching this attack on Iran. But it's important to remember that the White Empire, which is what we call it, rather to avoid all the commas and apostrophes, the White Empire has played its last trump card, which is a joker. So Trump is sort of like the id of American idiocy, which is just that we can do whatever we want, wherever we want. And his whole life and career is just based on piling one outrage on top of another to cover up the last one. So he is an accelerationist by nature. And he's played this card, but now everybody has to deal with it.
So if I might just add right here, you guys, I have been stunned that, because I've been waiting, cringing for this Iran-US war, certainly ever since the Axis of Evil speech, right? So it's what, a good 24 years. And I am stunned that this is the context in which Iran finally gets to destroy the American military presence in the region. Even let's go back 6 years to January of 2020 after the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, when Ayatollah Khamenei and the Iranian government, the Majlis, declared that the effort was going to be to push the United States out of the region. And has been continuing on that path. I could never have imagined where American, especially soft and global power, diplomatic power, there isn't any anymore, could never have even begun to dream, because Hollywood couldn't make the shit up and no one would have believed it. They would have said, yeah, just that's like some weird Eyes Wide Shut porno version, dude. I'm not interested. So this is the context. These pedo Zio murderers, like thieves, killing Ayatollah Khamenei at the peak of his power. I'm just saying, you couldn't script it any better. It would be impossible to script a novel of this any better, and Hollywood would have rejected it. So if this is the context in which the United States is finally going to bring it on, with the entire globe watching, and the news cycle has been so quick that we forget the insanity and the outrages of every day in between the 12-day war. And again, I'll just like the Huckabee thing alone, just that, the Qatar getting, bombed by the Zionists with, and the U.S. saying, that was crazy. And then the Qatari negotiators, their Mercedes, its steering column snapping in the middle of the desert, right? I'm just saying, you can't make up any of this shit. I could go with like 100 more examples. And this is the context in which Donald Trump, meanwhile, who else was he threatening? I forget, there was another country he was going to invade just today. Like, so if that's the context in which finally, like, we're going to have the big epic war between the U.S. and Iran, like, I'm taking it. It couldn't be any more perfect and glorious. I wouldn't say that Ayatollah Khamenei was playing like whatever 64D chess and just scripted this whole thing, but talk about suckering the United States in at a point when not even, except for the MAGA crowd, but American diehard, like, you know, whatever MAGA patriots, they themselves can see who started this shit, who pushed this shit, who begged and asked for it, who's doing it at the beck and call of the Zionists. It's just all out there. So This is the context. I'm a happy man at this point in that context. If it was going to happen, then you couldn't create in your wildest dreams a better scenario of context for this.
Outstanding. Yes.
On fire.
Yeah. I mean, this.
Tell it like it is, brother.
Yeah, you managed to like capture, you know, in words why I've been feeling a little buoyed. You know, like when this was on the cusp of happening, I was living with dread constantly. And the first thing I said, you know, at that morning live stream with Benji and Indy was like, I don't feel how I expected to feel, because I feel a little bit of a release from this dread, from this constant. I can't imagine you, Dave, 24 years. You've
been one more thing, just like really quickly in 15 seconds. The other thing is, think about Khamenei and what he has done. Did he actually script this so that he's gone now and the government can now go ahead and assemble the device? Because that is, by the way, it's my birthday today, 59 years old. And this is the greatest birthday gift that I could ever have contemplated receiving at this ripe old age. So I'm just saying, did Khamenei like really leave instructions even? Because if they're going to do this, if they're going to kill me, the Marja, in my home with my grandkids, then you have every right to go on, my dear community, to do whatever you deem necessary. I do believe, and I've been arguing, that they've had the parts just sitting on a shelf ready for A, B, C, D. They could be easily melded to even not even that recent of a model of Iranian ballistic missile. And so if that's where it's going, it is literally checkmate for American empire and Zionism in the region. And Iran doesn't even have to use the nukes. They'll just say, we're just going to continue to use our non-nuclear capabilities until you are gone. Bye-bye. Yeah. Like, and until people don't spit on other people in Palestine, because we have a one state and people can be free to worship as they want to or not worship and to live as human beings together. So,
Can I just?
I'm out. Drop the vape there.
I know. Top to the. It's not bye bye anymore, by the way. It's do bye bye anymore, right? So I'll have you know. just to say, you know, speaking of 24D chess, and brother Justin James in the comments says the past 2.5 years I've brought leftists to become to imbibe some Islamic spirituality or what have you, but. You know, when I heard you said this, and I went, well, that reminds me of this phrase I hear a lot, you know, which is God is the best planner.
Yeah.
And there is some. Yeah. And when we talk about being on the side of life, I am on the side of life. And my only justification for it is because I'm alive, you know, like I'm alive. So I'm on team life. Call me crazy. And because I'm on team life, I'm going to say it very clear to all of you now, and I want you to hear it and to be careful on the psychological war front about this. Because I am on the side of life, I know that life will survive this thing. So I have no fear for nuclear energy, like Brother Bob Marley would say, because I don't believe it will happen. I don't believe they want the Armageddon, the Holocaust, but their plans, I mean, like, you know, their cunning plans are all crashing around their ears. And I don't actually think this will take us to a nuclear Holocaust. Doesn't matter. There's nothing I could do to that could cause it anyway. But if we start thinking, oh my God, we're on the brink of a nuclear Holocaust, that will freeze us up. That will stop us from thinking, from imagining, from dreaming, from fighting, from speaking. And we are actually conceiving the possibility that death will win. No, death is not winning. This is why the free people of the world are rising up through provocation by the forces of death. That's their problem. And therefore, if you're on the side of life, you have to know that life is going to win, whether it's by religious belief or just my, you know, very simple down-to-earth spirituality. I'm alive, so I'm on the side of life.
But I think Iran has to be conscious of the nuclear threat, and not just in the form of tactical nukes, yes, but also in terms of what they did to Gaza through conventional munitions. But I do think, I mean, the one verse in the Quran that does keep coming back to me is Allah says, they are planning a scheme and so am I. So bear with those who deny the truth and let them be for a little while. And I think that concept of strategic patience was there in Khamenei. He certainly knew the Quran. I'm sure he was Hafiz. And they were able to think on a longer term. What the founder of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, said was that by 2027, Israel would be gone. He called that a Quranic prediction based on generations. He said the first generation was the Nakba, then the Intifada, then, and I think now we're the fourth generation in, which is the active, you know, military wing of Al-Qassam and Hamas. And they have a plan, and then they have faith. And then one thing I think, this is something, so Nasrallah said, he was talking about Khamenei. He said, personally speaking, and based on my personal experience with Khamenei, who repeated on more than one occasion that we all firmly believe in this divine province, promise. Gaza will triumph. Palestine will triumph. Palestine will prevail. He himself repeated the same words to us in the July war when there was no victory looming on the horizon, and to our fellow brothers in Gaza. And one thing that I find interesting about Khamenei philosophically is I find it challenging. So just for reference, I'm a Buddhist. But he talks about how faith has to be backed by action. He said faith that isn't lived through your arms and your legs and your brain and your body isn't faith, and it's essentially of no use. So Iran has prepared for this in a very deep way. Number one, by educating their population. There's this idea that the mullahs are backwards and theocratic, and they're actually just incredibly, just a moral leadership, and they're incredibly scientific. And they have figured out that all they have for airplanes is sort of F-4s and essentially US stuff and a few Russian things. But they have asymmetrically built a missile force, which is distributed across Iran. And especially that you can see that Khamenei, I think, was killed, I would think, in the morning, but the orders went out immediately. The orders had already been given. The plan has already been planned. This is a plan that is decades in the making. And for all the show of U.S. military equipment going by air, you can't actually resupply that much by air. And they don't have that much by air. And this is all known, I would say, within the U.S. military and certainly within the Iranian military. And they're in a weak position, which Trump, a weak man, has just pushed the button on. But Iran has to be careful. I think they have been careful. There's a Quranic injunction not to attack first. And even if people try to negotiate, you have to negotiate with them, even if they seem obviously perfidious. But they have set up the moral plane that anyone with a brain can see that Iran are the good guys.
And here. Hot. Yeah.
Yeah. So they have, and it's been painful, right? Because from the first day, from October 8th, I was like, when will, like, not Hezbollah cross the border? Like, when will Iran join? And but then again, that's not us first to say. Like, we're sitting safe at home. And they have to protect their own people. And they have to deal with something very dangerous, which is a dying empire backed into a corner. So they have to be incredibly careful. And as you can see, they are being methodical. And you know, God be with them.
Well, you know, I mean, well, there's so many things would be great to react to and so many thoughts come to mind. But one thing I wanted to, you know, address or point out in this that goes with this atmosphere and feeling of confidence based in reality. I think you're absolutely right, Indy. Like, you know, nobody can afford to be casual, and they're not. They have planned this. They have been very serious. You know, nobody can be casual, but we shouldn't lose heart in this moment. And I think one thing that really gave me incredible encouragement today was recognizing and learning. I'm trying to find the actual tweet from Trita Parsi, but elsewhere I saw it as well, that Iran seems to have been, that the Trump administration reportedly seems to have reached out to Iran about talking about a truce, ceasefire, some kind of way out, when he had every opportunity. They gave him every opportunity, agreeing to further restrictions than the JCPOA so that he could have, you know, his victory, his Trump moment to say, I'm the best deal maker ever. No president.
They gave him more than the JCPOA.
That's what I'm saying. They gave him more than the JCPOA so that he could declare a victory and end this and do a reasonable thing. But of course, he can't take the easy road, because whatever it is, like, he's in the thrall of like this aggressive Epstein empire, you know. But they gave him plenty of opportunities. He didn't take it. Now he's coming, realizing, recognizing this is not going to be the cakewalk he imagined. And they're reaching out, you know, feelers for a truce. Iran has rejected any discussion of a truce. They will not end this. They recognize, perhaps in some ways, it was a strategic error. The people who are in charge now are the people who survived the June 12-day war generation. They are not playing around, and they did not want to stop. It was Israel that asked for the truce. Iran agreed. Some people feel at that time they should never have agreed to that, but they should have continued to victory. This operation has, I don't know if it's an official name, but it's been characterized as Khatma Tufan, completing the flood.
Yes.
Okay? They are not going to stop until they have inflicted enough damage that either victory has been achieved fully, or at least deterrence truly has been established by giving a global lesson that everyone can see of how weak the U.S. empire is ultimately, and how strong a people who are united, who are coming out, just as David was saying, and I could play, you know, video of that. Millions of people in Inqilab Square, Revolution, you know, Square, even in Tajrish. Okay, there are people out. Okay, Tajrish, which I don't know anything about it except what Dave and others I've met tell me, that's the upper crust, kind of elite, secular, westernized, you know, kind of bourgeois sector of Tehran, you know, where, you know, you'll get the women wearing the fancy Gucci, you know, kind of Fendi, whatever clothes with their little dogs. And, you know, that's Tajrish, and they are out in the streets, right? So a people united like that are not going to be defeated by this empire. So that gave me so much encouragement that Iran felt it's in a position where it is not going to take a quick and easy, you know, true ceasefire that will just leave the same conditions. The security situation is necessary. They've set their target. They're going to remove U.S. bases and essentially the U.S. occupation. Remove the U.S. occupation. All you have, and this is worth talking about, we've seen the videos of the Bahrainis celebrating, you know, strikes on in Manama on that fifth, you know, fleet base. Yeah. If you remove the U.S. chokehold that is propping up these fake dynasties, these little oligarchies, if you remove them, there's a whole potential for revolution, especially in Bahrain, mm-hmm. a revolutionary potential. Or, you know, is the United Emirates going to be a South Asian republic? You know, I mean, all the workers there are
built it. I guess we should keep it.
Exactly. I mean, they built it. It's their sweat, blood, tears that have built that place. So, you know, maybe they deserve, according to John Locke, they've mixed their labor. It belongs to them. They should have ownership. But at any rate, that was one kind of thought I had, is that strategically, there's a lot of reason to feel confident because Iran is feeling confident. If they're feeling confident, why shouldn't we?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And this point about strategy, I think, is essential. I want to bracket a little thing. When I say let's not us have fear that this will lead to a nuclear holocaust, I'm not saying that the way to not lead to it wouldn't be, and I let the Iranian planners do their work because they've done it brilliantly so far, wouldn't be to say, hey, by the way, we just have a device, so don't even think about it. Whatever. What I'm saying is, it's more like a faith, an article of faith or wager or whatever. Let's not operate on the idea that we are on the brink of annihilation. I don't believe that's what we're on the brink of. We're on the brink of liberation. And I do believe this is actually an operation that is called, it has now been called, and it will be forever called, the closing of the flood, or the end, I don't know what the actual technical word is, because this reveals the absolute strategic brilliance of Martyr Yahya Sinwar, right? And if you look at what Yahya Sinwar did, this is a people's war. This is a national liberation war. This is a guerrilla war. And what is very specific about guerrilla wars is they are not actually military wars. They are psychological wars. They are wars for the soul of a nation. They are wars for class and national consciousness. This is what people's wars are. And in a strange way, the empire of idealism thinks they can create their reality by bullshit narratives and controlling social media. And before that, it was the press and the television or what have you. But they still think wars are won with guns and steel. Whereas the people resisting, the guerrilla, the nations, the class, knows that the war is won by changing the consciousness of the people, by uniting the consciousness of the people. That doesn't mean you go on the battlefield with, you know, flowers that you put in front of the genocidal killers. You also organize militarily. But as you were talking, indeed, suddenly came to me, the fact that those missiles are distributed all over, and did you see their launchers? They are like basic delivery trucks. So you can't actually spot them. And go ahead, you know, spend all your $30 million apiece dollars missiles on every single delivery truck that you see on the roads of Iran and see what where that gets you. So you have literally the people's missiles, in the sense that they're distributed everywhere. They're on mobile launchers that are just people's vehicles. They are underground, like every single national liberation people war has been using since Vietnam and also in Korea, which technology the North Koreans, our brothers or comrades, were, you know, true internationalist solidarity shared with the folks in Iran, in Lebanon, of course, and also in Gaza. And it's always done at a psychological level. So this is why they do what they do. And Khamenei goes and the people is vibrating. You see those videos? Have you seen the videos of the chanting Iranian people? They chant in a way, and I don't understand Farsi. I just Duolingo level 15 in Arabic. So, and you get so inspired. You know, someone on Twitter said, shoot this straight into my veins. And that's exactly what makes you feel. And the people aren't fighting. The Iranian people may not even, you know, have to take a gun to win this battle, because now you have the people's missiles. And on the other side, you have a bunch of whiny babies. Did you hear Chancellor Merz? Oh, by the way, did you see Milekovsky flew to Berlin? And, you know, I think he flew to Berlin because he wanted to make sure that Hitler's old bunker under the Reichstag was fit for purpose, because that's right. Where they have decided to end it all. And this is where, please go, and we'll go, we'll come and get you. And well, Merz was saying, Iran, did you see Merz? Iran must stop these unjust attacks. Every single attack of Iran has targeted something that they have the absolute intelligence of. You know, these Americans, they thought they were really smart. They evacuated the base and then they moved to the 24-30 stairs high rise next door, and they were filming the missiles coming, and so they go, oh shit, and you see this Shahid.
Yes.
Right into the room where I bet until I have solid evidence it's not the case, was some really high value command and control US military target. And of course, they have their little offices all over those fake countries of the Gulf who are just, you know, satrapies put together by empire to manage their interests. And the Iranians know every single place to the 5 meters. And that's it, guys. And this is why also the Bahraini population can cheer, because they know exactly that this Shahid is not going to fall on a schoolgirl and massacre more primary school girls than any single bombing in the history of bombing. They know it's going to go to the bad guys. And that is like poetic justice at a level I never knew I would experience in my life.
Indeed.
I just wanted to add one
thing. I don't know how to make it large. Here we go.
They're chanting Haydar, which means lion, one of the names for Imam Ali, and one of the names for militant Imam. Haydar.
Where is that? That isn't, is that Bahrain?
That's in Inqilab Square.
Okay.
Revolution,
sorry, I don't know it.
Revolution okay, right, Square right. In Tehran. Right. Yeah.
Because they started rounding up people in Bahrain, but I'm sure people in Bahrain are feeling that.
Oh, I've got some of those too. But Dave, you were about to say.
Yeah, just if this is what we're witnessing is the seal of the floods, if you will, the heating up of the wax for the seal as this began, I'll just say, one thing that really struck me. So I immediately saw a Telegram note came in. It's on, right? And that was another very long, let's say, long hour for me waiting for as news came in that it was on. Where are the contrails? Where is the Iranian response? Like, I thought it was going to be in 5 minutes. Like, what, you know, hair trigger? Let's go. The thing that just filled my heart, and which I'm sort of stunned by it. And so this is the only point that I'll really weigh on the military geek stuff here. But the fact that with the first Iranian ballistic missile strike, they got hits in Haifa, and there was one other, there were two. I was stunned because looking at both Iran's and Israel's rebuilding after the 12-day war and with the reconfiguration of American forces, the Navy off the coast of Palestine in the Mediterranean, I thought that it was going to be maybe a day or two of saturation missile strikes until they would start to permeate the aero system. The Iron Dome isn't as relevant for the long distance ballistics, but the THAAD system, right? having scored hits right out of the gate, I was immediately shocked. Like, whoa, I have to say, and I don't know if it was trolling, but somebody immediately tweeted like, yes, Iran has taken control of Israel's air defenses and they're wide open, which, you know, obviously that didn't happen. But the fact that this could be tweeted and would be funny to people because, oh yeah, exactly. I'm just able to read now, finally, Benji's mug. But so I'll just cut to the chase. The fact that it seems as though Israel's air defenses, especially between THAAD and the Arrow system, have been unable to stop even the initial Iranian barrages, and then subsequently just exponentially, as everyone has seen around the world, meeting or interdicting less and less and less, to the point where if you saw that video that just came out a few hours ago, you've got like 10 interceptors, which depending on the type of interceptor, a PAC-3 round for a Patriot system is about $3 to $4 million. Okay. So there's $40 million for maybe what, between $100,000 or $200,000 ballistic missile. This is completely unsustainable for even another few days. Trump is talking about a month. No. This will be over in a few days at this rate. So I won't discount the impact of, and they're probably using standoff munitions. There's no evidence of actual American or Israeli jets over Iranian territory, but they can do a lot of damage with standoff munitions. And so that will eventually add up and attrit the Iranian ability to launch this number of volleys. But I myself, knowing what Iran's capacities were, the size of the nation, which I'll remind people, it's bigger than Ukraine. Ukraine has been being attacked, for better or worse, for the last 4 years by Russia, which isn't just firing washing machines and shovels, and they still have air defenses, and they still launch drones, and they still put up a fight. And Iran is larger geographically than Ukraine. So my money is on the IRGC and Iranian salvos far outmatching the remaining number of THAAD missiles and Patriot missiles, which many of the viewers here are probably aware. In some cases, the United States only can produce several hundred per year. When 2 to 3 are fired average for every Iranian incoming missile, just do the math.
Well, here's a whole bunch more than that. I mean, let's take a look. I think this might. Oh my God.
Makes one say yo.
Keep it going, Dick Fry, at the end. Hey.
Oh my God. Notice the accents there, folks. Yeah, notice those.
Yeah, those are different.
those accents
were promised to them 3,000 years ago.
The report from Middle East Observer was like shock, express shock.
Accent,
as Iran missile strikes. But what?
So David was talking about how he was somewhat surprised that Israel was hit immediately. It's important to understand Israel's air defenses actually start in Doha from that 1.1 billion radar system. It's sort of like it fans out. It's a web. So you got Bahrain, Qatar, to a lesser extent, UAE, and their air defense really starts in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, and now, unfortunately, in Syria and Iraq. What's important to understand, what makes this different from the 12-day war, is because the United States attacked directly first, the rules of engagement have changed such that Iran can hit those U.S. sites. So before, they would have to go through those U.S. sites, get intercepted there, and then also get through the Israeli air defenses. But now the rules of engagement have changed such that they can take out the eyes, essentially the radar, of Israel. So now it's actually much easier to get, because Israel was being defended from the satrapies much more than from Israel itself.
Jordan downed so many in previous True Promise 1, 2, and 3. They were downing and all of that.
Yeah, but, and because that mythology was sustained that Israel is a real country and was just fighting Iran by itself, which, I mean, you can see Russia still playing along with in Ukraine despite it getting supplied from other countries. But now that mythology is shattered because Trump has been dragged in directly. So now they're able to engage directly. And so what I say, I talk about this term like white empire all the time, because it's important to understand it's a longer historical process than just the Americans. For Sri Lanka, we were colonized, I mean, now through the IMF by the Americans, by the British, by the Dutch, by the Portuguese. And for us on the bottom, like, what's the difference, right? They fly like different combinations of red, white, and blue generally.
You're gonna force me to start talking about the Crusades, my friend.
But if you read about the Crusades, this has happened before, and down to the starvation sieges of
cities. Got you down for Wednesdays. On Wednesday, you're gonna speak what you want. Yeah,
the slaughter of civilians, man. It's all thematic. There, absolutely. But
there was a question. Red Kitty is a great.
I can just address that really quickly. Basically, standoff munitions. Munitions basically like kinetic energy that you can drop from afar, and that so specifically what they're doing is they're dropping glide bombs or missiles from above, say, Iraqi territory at 40 or 45,000 feet, at which case they already have the speed and the momentum with the glide abilities and or if they're powered to reach a target even in Tehran or anywhere in Iran. So during the 12-day war, there is no evidence whatsoever that the United States or Israel ever actually overflew, except for the Midnight Hammer fake scripted attack at the end, which was enabled and planned and accepted by Iranian leadership for better or worse at the time. And so likewise, there's no evidence that there are actually Israeli or American aircraft over Iranian territory, but they can do huge damage by flying right up to the border, if you will. They can't even really get that close to the border, but say within 30, 40 miles of the border at very high altitude, very high speed, and dropping this thing that then with momentum continues on to the target. So I'm just saying that the destructive power of standoff munitions cannot be underestimated. At the same time, these standoff munitions are hugely expensive, the American versions of them. Russia has just developed during the SMO, during the war in Ukraine, a kit that they can actually attach to their dumb bombs, basically 2,000-pound bombs that are based, you know, World War II era. They have ones from 1950s in stock that they can just attach this kit to. It's got like a hose clamp on it, and once it drops, then the wings come out, and it's essentially a long-distance standoff munition. So anyway, that's what the United States and Israel have been attacking Iran with, that and cruise missiles.
So militarily, we're actually witnessing a paradigm shift from the fighter bomb model. The old fighter bomb model is you fly a fighter like that and you drop a bomb like that. So when you talk about standoff munitions, you basically put the fighter up, but it's kind of like a fixed platform, and then you shoot like that. United States is not geared around that, right? It's geared around, and as much as you can say industrialized, it's built around dropping expensive bombs on poor people that can't, that don't have air defenses.
Yeah.
So Iran has enough air defenses. Plus these guys they're too scared to lose their precious equipment that they won't risk looting. Because for them, losing a fighter jet itself is worse than losing land. That itself is a big psychological blow to them. But they're not geared for that type of war. What they're geared for is like the incineration of Gaza, which is you fly an expensive plane and drop a 2,000-pound bomb on a refugee camp. But that's not what they're facing here. And Iran has made a strategic decision long ago that we cannot compete with them on the fighter bomb model. So they don't really have an indigenous fighter jet, and they haven't really imported significant amounts of MiGs or anything. But they have decided that, hey, we have this incredibly rocky, mountainous terrain. We can build mobile missiles and shoot it. And I think the proof of this military concept has been in Yemen, where a force without really an air force or a navy was able to establish air and sea supremacy by having mobile missiles. So it is a paradigm shift in warfare from the fighter model to the missile model. And America has missed that technological jump almost entirely.
And I want to go back to the concept of people's war, because Russian weapons are actually the weapons of a people's army. Like they are, you know, the weapons of the Red Army. And there's this joke going on in military circles, which I've been reading more military stuff since 2017 than I ever thought I would. You know, I managed to skive off military service in France as a teenager. And basically the thing that's said, and Ukraine is the place where it was said, because the Ukrainians, you know, before being colonized by empire and kitted with all that expensive boutique stuff meant to maximize shareholder value, were trained in the art of using people's weapons. And they basically, the Ukrainians are saying, well, the problem with your weapons is they don't work very well. And when they don't work anymore, you have to call in somebody in Quantico, and it takes 2 weeks before they come. A Russian weapon, you know what you do? You take a sledgehammer, you hit it twice, and it works again. And this is the key, you know, like this radar that Indica was talking about, right? It covered, 5,000 kilometers around. It was the most sophisticated radar, more than $1.1 billion on the budget. It's probably more expensive than this. And it meant the squatters had 7 minutes warning. And Iran took it out with a $30,000 flying lawnmower, right? Which, right, by the way, Iran gave the technology of to Russia.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the provoked by empire, legitimate Russian defense of the culturally Russian population of Eastern Ukraine. And this we need to remember, because it's really the people against the Epstein class. It's really the people against. But these people, they hate humanity so much that they even abuse their own children, right? Like, we know Andrew, Prince Andrew, was probably abused by Mountbatten. They sold, you've seen the Epstein files, they sold their children to Epstein, like ruling class people. These are people who have just taken leave of humanity. And on the other side, you have the people, and the people who live in the real world, they want stuff that works. You know, they don't want a car that's super expensive that you can talk to your friends about, but can't get out of the garage without needing, you know, 2 hours of repairs every day, which is exactly what the U.S. Army is. And it was already like this in Vietnam, you know, these M16s. As soon as you went in a sandy environment, they stopped working. Your AK-47, a people's weapon, was designed in, 45, I believe, and it's still going, and it's still one of the most effective people's weapon there ever was.
Yeah, and there's a reason it's on so many liberation movements' flags.
Mm-hmm. I would just say, just to just add on to great, great points, both Indy and Benji there, the attrition rate of American hardware that has been put into service is also very high because of the dynamics of especially what Benji just explained about these boutique weapons. And so all those, you know, those graphics that came out, how many, you know, F-22s are there, even right there. I follow Will Shriver. It might've been Benji turned me on to Will. Yeah. I don't know if you saw Will. He was like, hey, you know, they're going to send F-22s out, but they sent 12 out. But I bet you that within like a day, it's down to 11. And he tweeted it. And before they even arrived, one had already done what he said it was going to do. It blew a fuel line or something, had to turn back. So there were only 11. So right out of the gate, his point had already been demonstrated. And then the Chinese satellite photos showed, hey, there's the 11 F-22s sitting on the tarmac, and it's not 12. So with every day that this goes on, it's another reason why Trump, you know, started it on whatever late Friday, early Saturday morning, because markets are going to open tomorrow and we're going to have this thing, you know, one and done. And that's not happening, actually. And just the attrition rate of the stuff that hasn't been shot at or shot down, but that just sucks and is sort of built like this way by design, so that we can all continue to fund it. This is all for me very, very heartening. I can't even really believe we're here already, but here we are. So
yeah. Did you see the pictures of Trump at the Mar-a-Lago Situation Room?
I'm not a body language expert,
but these guys are defeated. And didn't you see today's picture taken where you see Trump screaming his head off at Exeth, who's probably hungover from the day after the night before? This is the moment. This is it. Like, they are realizing they literally bit something they could not chew, and it's going to choke them. And what you just put, Adnan, is exactly this, you know, racing to complete the mission before munitions run over. Munitions run over. You're the fucking...
the most powerful empire in the history of the world. The galaxy. Democracy. Yeah.
"We've never seen anything so powerful. We will hit them. What a, you know, it would be a shame if something happened to these great people."
I mean, I think in a lot of ways, what we're witnessing is a going out of business sale of the military industrial complex. They're like, "We got these JDAMs, which are like the dumb bombs. Let's drop them on some refugee camps. We have artillery, which we're not really making anymore. Let's go drop it on Ukraine. And then now let's use like the good stuff on Iran." It's a fire sale. It's a fire sale of depreciating firepower. Like, the United States is running the depreciation table. And if you read the U.S. military reports, it's interesting because they're quite honest about this. They're like, "Our stuff doesn't work. It costs $1 billion. We need to like change something." Every report I read says like, "We need to reform this." They don't reform. Like, the same people have failed upwards since they were attacking Iran, I don't know, God knows how many years ago. Like, in America, people talk about like, "Oh, China purged this guy and purged that guy." Yeah, maybe you should purge your military occasionally. And in a way, like, when you kill the ranks of Iran's military, you are also replenishing those ranks. Whereas the U.S. military ranks is only people who failed upwards, only people who said yes to every stupid idea ever given. And so you end up here with the logical conclusion of like, a bit, you know, a cameo star in Home Alone 2 directing the military to attack a serious civilization.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but this gets to a point that actually I'm interested in here about this cost analysis. Like, you know, yes, it's incredibly inefficient. That's kind of the point. You know,
that is a point.
Basically,
yeah.
You know, a distribution. It's welfare for, you know, military industrial, you know, investors, you know, that elite Epstein class again, you know, like, I mean, but these are people who are involved in, you know, feeding at the trough of U.S. lavish U.S. military spending. And that's why sometimes I think the economic analysis, you know, is really a little bit besides the point, in the sense that it can't afford it. But if, you know, if they keep deficit spending, they don't care. They're just taking the money away and handing it to their friends. You know, it only, what it requires is at a certain point, the creditors, and I think they've slowed in terms of buying treasuries now, like the people, you know, in the world, the Gulf is maybe not buying as many. They were always a reliable group, but I think with this war, there might be a little slowdown in their, like, you know, purchase of U.S. treasuries right now, especially since their oil income is about to plummet or is plummeting right now as we speak. But like, if China decides that it is not going to bail out the U.S. financially by purchasing treasuries, then you could have that economic argument. But I think, like,
they're already doing it. They have drawn down more than ever.
But, you know, but the point is that they don't, you know, this ruling class doesn't care how much it costs, because that's just another, you know, opportunity to, you know, have another big government contract for, you know, some inefficient provider and so on. And I think somebody, you know, had a really interesting point, you know, that, you know, it isn't a completely new point, but it sort of goes together very nicely with, you know, the new way of accumulation under capitalism, basically, which is that, is that this is kind of a rationalized way of handling things now, where you get, you know, financialization, you know, there's no place for them to really, you know, produce value. But what they do is create these wars where you spend all this money for the weapons to destroy a place and then get the contracts, you know, to rebuild, and basically require the place you've invaded to take out all of these loans for the reconstruction. And then so all of the infrastructure now has been privatized. But better than just it being privatized is that the process of its privatization has also generated these, you know, kind of excess profits and income for the war makers, right? So the war and the reconstruction are part of an imperialist design of accumulation that produces subordination by destroying your society, and then even when it's rebuilt, now it's owned by others, right? That's the real destruction of sovereignty that is at stake. And that's why, that's what this is really about, is Iran just is resisting being put under the, you know, kind of, you know, by defending its sovereignty, it's preventing itself from being put through this process. If it's successful in defeating this kind of process of, I would call it, you know, no longer primitive accumulation, but kind of rationalized barbaric accumulation, that if it is capable of resisting this, escaping that process, and defeating this attempt to subject it to that accumulative process, that is a massive victory of world historical proportions for the entire global South.
Could I make a point about this? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'd like to make a point about this. So, you know, this is very close to the beautiful, brilliant, and I believe Marxism progressing analysis of comrade Ali Kadri.
Yeah.
Who has basically, you know, is looked at the whole logic of capital, and it's not just exploiting workers anymore and shortchanging them on the value of their labor. It's really turning everything that is alive into a commodity, i.e. into dead stuff, and so producing death. And death and shortening lifespans, genocide, whether structural or active, destroying nature, destroying social nature, that is that very fine equilibrium between populations and their natural environment and their cultures and their spirituality that has evolved over millennia. Destroying all this is a source of value. And this is the way capitalism works. So primitive accumulation is always ongoing, and it's always violent. It's not something that happened once in Britain, in England, when they enclosed the commons. It's done on an ongoing basis by violently forcing people in reducing what they want is to reduce the cost of social reproduction, right? So if you kill people, if they die because of illness, it costs less to maintain them in health, to educate them, to feed them, and all the rest of it. So they make profit out of this. This is the logic of capital. And this is why, by the way, if you haven't understood yet, countries like China, like Russia, like Iran are not imperialist. Even if they invaded other countries for stupid reasons, they still would not be imperialist, because they do not extract value by this ongoing violence, which has been the modus operandi of white empires for the past 500 years. And on the, but to work, and we have gone somewhere from the imperialism of Lenin, it's now holding the world, this imperialist system, which is a world system, through financial capitalism, which takes the form of the dollar domination of the world economy. And the minute the world economy is not denominated in dollar anymore, the whole thing crumbles. And if you look at the actual structure of the world financial system, and it's an inner dialectical contradiction of the system itself, it has actually been reduced simply because the US empire is so violent that it sanctioned everybody out of its own financial sphere. So people have had to create their own alternative systems. And China and Russia and Iran have now a system that will replace the dollar system. The Saudis are selling all their oil in RMBs, right? In Chinese currency now. So they cannot hold the financial domination of the world anymore to the dollar domination. And this is just like sand seeping to their hands, and it's just over. And this is why there is a historic chance to do something. And this is why the strategic patience was important. And by the way, they always make the mistake themselves. Like, it's always an unforced error, because there was a chance, even until last week, that the pro imperialist, pro-capitalist wing of the Russian oligarchy, if you like, of the Russian class compromise, which wanted to do a separate peace with the US and reintegrate their houses in Monte Carlo and all the rest of it, would have dropped all the rest of the, you know, the BRICS and the world resistance in the way that the Indians tried to do this week, right? Modi's, like, fascists are stupid, right? They always make the wrong move at the worst possible time. This is what Modi did last week. And so, yeah. and they blew it. They blew it. And do you know how they blew it? You know they blew it because Putin took the time to have himself filmed for 5 long minutes, taking the biggest bunch of flowers you ever saw in your life to honor the memory of Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Mm. And in that instant, the empire itself closed the only escape hatch it had and has put Russia firmly on the side of Iran. And China, that I know many comrades, and I've had comrades even that they're still comrades, but it's been tough, you know, because they wanted China to just go come and stop everything. China is very active in this thing. They were already active. I mentioned it in the 12 Days War. They have this incredible ship that is so advanced electronically that the US can't see it if it's just over the horizon. They have nothing to see it, right? And it was in the Gulf in June. It helped a little bit then. We know now for sure that China did help the Yemenis with targeting. And now they've moved everything to the Baidu system that the empire can't do anything about. And the targeting is that precise because of this. You know, the Iranians are masters engineer, and they've already got the most precise missiles you could have, but you still need the targeting. And now the Chinese are providing it to them. And this is how you win against an empire like this. It's a kind of a Sun Tzu move, because they go against the weaker partner, but they can't even beat the weakest partner. They're going to get bloody nose from the weaker partner, and the other, they're not even peers. They're superior in every dimension, economic, military, and moral, of course, are just, you know, helping the weak guy. And it's so moral as well. And they will make sure that the crazy mafia boss is not going to blow up the planet. So, you know, take heart, brothers and sisters, and please take the good news to everybody around you and do something about it. Don't just think it's going to happen. We need to build that consciousness that it's over and we need something new.
I want to comment on something Adnan said, if you don't mind, because it got me thinking. But what Iran is doing is kind of, what they're really doing is resisting being eaten by capital. And yeah, when you read Marx, he talks about how capitalists are basically interchangeable. They're sort of placeholders for capital. And if you got rid of Trump, which I think U.S. liberals think is going to solve everything, as Césaire said, like, colonization cries out for its Hitler. So mm-hmm. some other Hitler will come to take this thing into fascism. So when Benji and I talk, we actually talk about capital as a form of AI. Because yes, in Sri Lanka, we were colonized by corporations first. And these corporations are algorithmically endowed to just consume resources and labor and then spit out profit and waste heat, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, in biological terms, you could just describe that as a life form closer to cancer than anything else. and if you, like, in computer science, there's this one study where they talk about, they asked an algorithm to move forward. So it came up with the idea to stack blocks on top of each other and fall, to crash, and then that would move it forward. So algorithmically, that worked. And you can see that happening with the U.S. military complex. They figured out, wait, if we just go into wars and lose, we make more money. And so that's what it's just building up these stacks of bombs and then failing over and over again. But that has a logical conclusion, which is sort of resource exhaustion.
Huh. I would just add, this is brilliant. I'm learning so much from you guys, but it just fascinatingly how what's going on in the Gulf and Iran in many ways relates directly back to the petrodollar system, petrodollar recycling, which involves both the investment in American debt, but also the continual purchase of American arms. And my favorite totem of the empire, the Patriot system, which most of us are aware never worked. The claims during the first Gulf War that it hit 99% of the incoming missiles. In fact, Ted Postol came out with a report 6 months later in 1991. They didn't hit a single incoming missile. I have argued that for the last 30 years that the Patriot system is simply a totem. It's cardboard. It doesn't work. It was never intended to work. having
it works to make money. Yeah, it works for what it's designed for.
Meant you wouldn't be attacked, because if anybody ever attacked it, they would incur the wrath of the arsenal of democracy and the greatest superpower on earth. And therefore, so it was sold for billions of dollars to underwrite other Raytheon projects that maybe worked or maybe didn't, like the F-35. The desperate need for American empire, and in, if you want to maintain the Wolfowitz doctrine with this much debt, to continue the petrodollar system and petrodollar recycling, which between Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Libya, it has been in the process of diminishing and dying. So this also, in many ways, the dynamics in the Gulf are all about the United States attempting to assert what would be its lifeblood and to maintain it, which is the petrodollar system, reliant on the purchase of our debt and the purchase of our weapons. All of this is what's at stake for the empire. And I just say again, I think Soleimani and Ayatollah Khamenei understood this very well.
Well, people, we've been, I feel like king like all night. I'm just so pleased to, you know, have your company and fellowship during this. And I hope, you know, you're as buoyed by these conversations and renewed for continuing to fight the Psy War, the information war, to get involved in our own communities to fight fascism, you know, domestically and against, you know, this, you know, crusading imperialist war abroad. And the connections between the two become ever, ever, you know, more clear, and the stakes more certain about how enormously important this resistance of Iran is to the fate of the world, our world and our future. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to have this confab and have this encouragement, this sense of community, and, you know, with a little bit of lightheartedness, give ourselves light hearts. And so, you know, before we leave, I do want to just remind everybody, you know, we have been doing a fundraiser for the Samir Project. We didn't start at the beginning with the announcement and see how much we could raise. That's usually just a Friday office hours tradition we've developed, but we should never forget Palestine. We must free Palestine. Let's do our part. I understand that today, you know, access was cut off again, you know, by the fascist Zionist regime to prevent much needed food, medicine to come in. So if you can make a donation to the Samir Project, Palestinian Mutual Aid organization working in Gaza, it'll go a long way. So, you know, I'll put that in the description of this episode, but please do remember to do that. As we go around concluding, you know, maybe you can tell people where to contact you, how to follow. Dave, you don't have a whole lot of like social media presence, but, you know, how should people kind of follow your work? And or, you know, what would you ask people? You can even plug, you know, better sources of, you know, knowledge and information. I know a lot of people are relying on people they trust on Twitter, X, etc. But you know, where else might people go to keep abreast of events? What are you, you said you're like constantly dealing with all the information coming
in. Yeah. Well,
be watching and reading.
I'll just say I'm a big fan of the Adnan Hussein show, as well as Resistance is Fertile. And that's where I can sometimes be found. They'll humor me and my.
And where you may be found in the future as well.
Thank you. I will say that one of the reasons I probably still have a job is because I never got on social media. So I oftentimes think that, and based on things that are in my mind, that I'm then not able to tweet. So really, it's I've got a pretty like long list of stuff if you do a search for my name in X, because of all the Press TV stuff that's been published. But I'll just say I remain a huge ardent fan of the Gray Zone, and so I just as one source that I think is absolutely essential. The Cradle has been kicking ass as well.
Cradle
so
has been excellent.
Everybody's got their favorites, but I regularly read what they have to say because I find it very valuable. But again, and I just want to say love to you, brothers. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's really I have genuinely learned a lot, and it's also just been very, very heartening. So
great. Indy.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been very nice to talk to people that aren't my cat. I really appreciate the opportunity. In terms of sources, what I've been reading honestly is the Quran, because it feels like it's talking about today. I'm also like, I've been using Telegram for resistance news network in general, but for Iran in particular, Fortros Resistance, FOTROS and an extra E at the end of resistance, has been a good source for me. And I would also say just like follow your own heart and your instincts, right? Mm-hmm. If you can't see that, you know, the people killing babies in their day job and then raping them in their vacations are bad, I think, you know, and that the people and like the gentle old man, like tweeting poetry and like fighting colonialism for his whole life is good. Then, I mean, I don't know. You need to like look into your own heart a bit. I think now things are becoming apparent and we have to reconstruct our worldview as the old world falls apart.
Yeah. Is it okay if I finish a thought that I kind of lost track of? Okay. So I started at one point saying how I believe Martyr Yahya Sinwar was one of the great strategic genius, maybe the greatest strategic genius of people's war ever. And the competition is stiff, you know, with the Vietnamese, the Chinese, there are many Africans also. And because I think it's the century of the global South that's opening. It's going to be the century of humiliation for the West, and not a minute too soon. I hope it's 500 years. I hope that Western so-called civilization that never was one actually disappears. It was an aberration. But what I mean is it's Sun Tzu, right? It's not Clausewitz anymore. It's Sun Tzu. Sinwar went for 20 years to learn about the enemy. He knew them better than they knew themselves. Then he learned about people's war. Then he learned about how you build a people's army, your own weapons, your own resilience. You stay in the people. And, you know, when he launched the flood, maybe he was pushed. Like there is some credible rumors. I don't know how to say it's evidence, but that they were planning an operation into Gaza, right? And when their very good intelligence heard about it, they hastened a little bit their operation, right? And he called it the flood he probably thought of the name 20 years before. I'm going to believe that. I'm going to make up that story. And he called it the flood because he knew exactly what it was going to do. It was going to wash away every single illusion of that empire. And you know, when the sea moves away, then you see who's clothed and who's in their not even underwear, right? And this is exactly what we've seen. And what we've seen is we are actually governed by demons. I mean, you know, it used to be the purview of lunatics to talk about shape-shifting lizards that drank the blood of babies. Maybe they're not lizards, but everything else turned out to be true. And they've been trying like crazy, like maniacs, to go back to the world of before the flood. But you can never go back to the world of before the flood. And this is why calling it the end of the flood is also world historic, I believe. And we need to understand this. You know, I'm fond of saying in a flood, there is not one drop of water that is bigger than the other. It takes all the drops of water to make a flood, and you are a drop of water. Your voice, your memes, your jokes, by the way, this is, I think, shitposters of the world unite and take over. This is your opportunity to shine, you know, like they are in their not even underwear. The emperor is naked and is disgusting. So you can make fun of them as much as you can because they are so narcissistic that you really wound them. You don't wound the pure-hearted if you make fun of them. You know, they're humble, as Khamenei was. So that's what's going on. You are a drop. make sure that drop goes, you know, like when you're on top of a mountain, you go either that way or that way. You go towards the way of life. And this is why we're here today. And thank you, life, for having made this little drop that I am flow in the same direction as you three beautiful souls. It is one of the gifts of my life. And you're a young man, David, by the way, because I don't even remember how young I am, at 62 at least. And it's just beautiful. So, and there are many, many of us drops out there, and we're gathering, we're recognizing that we're made of the same stuff because we're all human.
Beautiful, man.
We are in the camp of life. Oh. And this is a beautiful ritual, Gul Galtan, picture from Semnan in Iran, where babies are bathed in fresh rose petals to mark the beginning of the first spring of their lives. We're coming to Nowruz rather soon, later this month, which is the Persian New Year. And I think at this time, this is the best contrast to say the Epstein Empire, as I think it was Dr. Izadi said in a excellent interview, that you know, we're facing the Epstein class, Epstein Empire, that you know, rapes little girls and then bombs little girls, you know, and instead we want to bathe little girls with their mothers bathe them in fresh rose petals to celebrate life. And inshallah, all of these people of Iran and the beautiful Iranian women, that these girls will grow up to be engineers and doctors and scientists, as so many of their older sisters and mothers have, and build a sovereign, independent nation of Iran that is a beacon to the global south. That's what we want to see. And so that's why, you know, we wanted to talk about how Iran has struck back against the Epstein Empire. And it's great to have so many of you in the chat. There was, like, you know, between all of the streams that we had, at some point over 1,000 live, you know, joining us for a wonderful conversation. A wonderful discussion in the chat. I appreciate you all so much. And it's been great to have this conversation. So thank you all. And, you know, peace with justice, if you can fight for it, as Benji likes to add, that if you can fight for it, from our pious forebears who inspire us, said that.
I borrowed from Jared Ball, I have to say, who himself is quoting George Jackson.
Yeah, he's quoting George Jackson. Exactly. You know, another martyr, you know, in the cause of freedom. So peace with justice, and solidarity to you all.
Free Palestine, and victory to the free people of the world.
Amen.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.